The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. Tomorrow is December 7th, the anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which we now know was engineered by U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt. Last week, Dr. Andreas Westerle talked to us about the Roosevelts and their unstable temperaments, but especially the deceitful Franklin. Tonight, on the eve of this anniversary, I had scheduled as my guest Gordon Duff, senior editor of VeteransToday.com. And I thought it was going to be a very exciting program because he had written a couple of blogs on the Holocaust, which were decidedly revisionist in content. And I'd approached him on the basis of those articles, asking him to come on my program to talk about them. He had immediately agreed, and we had a congenial emailing back and forth getting the logistics set up. There's no doubt that he's a congenial personality, so I was encouraged that this was going to be a great Heretics Hour. Gordon had told me that he would probably skirt around some things, and I told him that he was welcome to do that all he wanted, but he didn't ask me to skirt, and I didn't say I would. So on Friday, this past Friday, we had a pre-recording conversation, which actually went on far too long and got into a small disagreement. I was trying to bring it to an end and get started on the actual program when Duff abruptly said he would no longer do the interview and hung up. So we called him back twice, but he wouldn't answer. Thus, Mike Connor left a message for him asking him to call us if he wanted to, and later, Mike did get through to him and talked to Duff for a while, and Duff gave us his reason for quitting and hanging up this. It's pretty close to what he said. She doesn't know enough. She doesn't know about the Bush connection with the Nazis. So this is where I'm going to begin tonight's show, ladies and gentlemen. My intention is not to attack Gordon Duff, but my original intention was to question Duff about some of the things he has written, and in a sense to ask him, do you really believe this? And if you do, why? And what is the evidence? Or at least, what do you base it on? It was not going to be a softball interview, which is what he gets from everyone else, if I might say. So I believe that Gordon was testing to see what he could expect from me in the interview. That's why he went on so long. And when he came upon something that I was not going to let pass, he had the opportunity to decline it before it ever started. I also believe, and I'm sure of this, that Gordon didn't hang up because I didn't know enough, quote unquote, but because I know too much. He wasn't going to be able to pass what I would call half-baked conspiracy theories off on me without a counter-argument from me. So let me tell you exactly what he claims I didn't know. Duff started talking about the Bush family connection to the Nazis. I know where he's leading with that. That is, the Nazis are running America today. I didn't want to get into that, meaning especially while we still weren't recording the program, and he retorted, you don't know about the Bush connections with the Nazis? Well, of course, I know about it, but I don't put credence into a great deal that's written about it, so I answered, Mr. Duff, no, I don't know. You tell me. Where is your evidence and what do you base it on? Something like that, meaning I don't know that to be a fact. And he said, there are documents in the Truman hearings. And I said, what documents? What Truman hearings? Meaning, you can't just say documents in Truman hearings. At which point he said something like, well, if you don't know, then he said, I've decided I'm going to decline this interview. And he hung up the phone. Now, I suppose everyone can have their take on this, but I don't think a radio guest cares much how much their interviewer knows. They only care how much they want to say that they'll be allowed to say without any argument, or even with an argument, but mostly they would prefer not to have an argument. And that's why he didn't refuse the interview, because I didn't know enough, but that's a good ruse. I would say Gordon is a smart man, and he's used to being slippery when he needs to be. He's been in many, many kinds of environments and situations, and he knows exactly what he's doing. So all right, I'm going to begin by examining the Bush connection to the Nazis, and we'll see who knows what. I also want to go through the two blogs dealing with the Holocaust that Gordon wrote, which is what I had intended to do on the program with him, but they're going to have to wait maybe till next week, and actually probably. So I am now going to tell you what I've done in order to search out to find the most authoritative source I could find for this Bush-Nazi connection that's coming up so much on the internet and on radio programs, internet radio programs today, and these so-called documents that prove everything that's being said. So in order to discover the most credible information I could find, I decided that an article written by Toby Rogers titled "Heir to the Holocaust" was carefully compiled from everything that was known on the subject, including the books, the famous documents, in quotes, and even the Truman hearings. I'm going to go through how this connection is established by what is known. If any listeners, including Gordon Duff and maybe his supporters, can supply me with something that is left out here, I would appreciate it. This article is fairly long, not too long. It seems to be pretty careful, but it cleverly leaves out many things and connects things that don't really, without really connecting them. And I'm going to point all this out. Its title is "Heir to the Holocaust: Prescott Bush, 1.5 million, and Auschwitz: How the Bush Family Wealth is Linked to the Holocaust" by Toby Rogers. It was published in Clamor Magazine. Clamor Magazine is no longer being published. This title tells us that the whole story about Prescott Bush is really just connecting his family wealth to the Holocaust. Now it's claimed that during the war, the company made use of Nazi slave labor from the concentration camps, including Auschwitz. It's also claimed that documents from the U.S. National Archive, declassified last year, linked Bush to CSSC, the Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, although it is not clear if he and UBC were still involved in the company when Tyson's American assets were seized in 1942. As a matter of fact, that has never been cleared up. Now, why there is an attempt to do that is to make more people and more fortunes available for reparation claims. For those who have lived off the Holocaust since 1945 and want to continue to do so in the future, it helps a lot to involve more and more fortunes, whether personal, family, or business, as being made through the sufferings of the Jews, and really as many others as they can attach. But we're going to find out that this so-called big conspiracy is nothing more than banking business as usual. And this is a pretty stressed out hypothesis that is being put across here. So it starts out talking about a book, a couple of books that this author uses, I suppose, for a lot of his facts here. And he says that this whole connection between Prescott Bush and Fritz Tyson was a great German industrialist of that time, of that era, and he has been made to be very guilty of using slave labor and cooperating with Hitler and Himmler and the Holocaust and all of that stuff. So he says that this connection between Bush and Tyson was first reported in 1994 by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens in a book called "The Secret Wars Against Jews: How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People." And John Loftus and Mark Ahrens are both Jews. And as a matter of fact, I'll tell you right now that at the end of this article, the author writes, special thanks to John Loftus, who he describes as an Emmy-winning journalist, author, and current president of the Florida Holocaust Museum. So here we have someone who is supposed to be a journalist, but he's also became president of the Florida Holocaust Museum. So you think he has a kind of bias in a certain direction? What kind of a journalist is that? But the other book that is mentioned right in the beginning is Charles Higgins' book, which I mentioned in my program way back about Adolf Hitler and the and Wall Street. And this book is Trading with the Enemy, the Nazi American Money Plot, 1933-1949. Here's some of the first hard information. A classified Dutch intelligence file, which was leaked by a courageous Dutch intelligence officer, confirms absolutely, along with surfaced information from U.S. government archives, it confirms direct links between Bush, Tyson, and genocide profits from Auschwitz. Well, first, this courageous Dutch intelligence officer is never named. I have not seen the intelligence file, but I have seen the documents from the U.S. government archives, and they certainly confirm that the bank that Bush worked for was doing business in Germany, and that there were some connections with Tyson, and that's about it. We'll get into that later. Here we have W.A. Harriman & Company in New York City. If you're old enough, you are familiar with the name Harriman. If you're younger, you might not be, but they were a very big, very wealthy, very elitist banking company in the U.S. And the author here says that he hired George Herbert Walker, which is Bush's grandfather, and I guess George W. Bush's great-grandfather, George Herbert Walker. They hired him to run the operation. What operation? I guess the Harriman operation. And he hired his brother, Roland Harriman, as vice president. Okay, so what? And then it says in 1922, Harriman traveled to Germany to set up a branch of his bank in Berlin. Okay, that was common practice. Berlin was a world capital, even though Germany had, after losing the war, was put under this very onerous Versailles Treaty and was struggling, but still there was money to be made for sure, and so there went Harriman to open a bank there in Berlin. Now they say right after this, which has no real connection, but in October 1923, Fritz Tyson, who was a German industrialist, visited one of Germany's military heroes, General Erich Ludendorff, who was a great hero of the World War I. And he says that during 1918, during the socialist rule in Berlin, which really you need to read communist. See, this is another way where they keep calling things socialist that were communist. The communists were trying to take over Germany in 1918, even before the war ended and at the end of the war. And this is where the big fighting went on with the Free Corps and so on. And Ludendorff was on the side of the Free Corps. And they eventually defeated the communists and drove them at least out of power, if not out of the country. And so the author says that the German industrialists and businessmen and so on were indebted to Ludendorff for doing this because they didn't want the communists. Of course they didn't. And so on. And he says that Ludendorff respected Hitler and said that he's the only man who has any political sense. Of course, that's made out to be something evil today, but that was true at the time. Tyson gave Ludendorff 100,000 gold marks, which is supposedly only amounted to $25,000 for the Nazi Party at that time. This is in 1923. So, you know, here you have businessmen donating to a political party that they think will be most advantageous to their interests. So what? Isn't that always what goes on? Again, you see, this is just common practice. There's nothing strange about this. And it says that others in the steel and coal industry soon followed Tyson's lead. Well, Tyson was in the steel and coal industries. Yeah, so some others did. But it said none came close to matching that $25,000 that Tyson gave. So they weren't giving huge amounts of money, as has been claimed, even in by Gordon Duff, that Hitler was reveling in riches and living the life of a millionaire, because of all this money that was being thrown at him by these evil fascist industrialists and so on. That is just not true. And the Tysons says, through the bank of Voor Handel in Zwievaard opened the Union Banking Corporation in 1924. Now, here is a leap where there is no connection made between Tyson and Schiefert, the Dutch company. But yet it says that Tyson did open this bank himself through that. I haven't seen this connection being made at all. And that in 1924, the managing director of this Dutch bank, a man named Koevenhoven, traveled to New York to meet with Walker and the Herman brothers. So here we have the Dutch banker meeting with Walker and Herman and their bank people in New York, and no Tyson is there, but somehow he supposedly, they're intimating that he is behind it, but I don't see any proof. And then they established the Union Banking Corporation in New York between this Dutch bank and the Herman Bank. They've just made a new bank. So this is what we have so far. Now, okay, Walker and Harriman's firm sold over $50 million worth of German bonds to American investors, this Union Banking Corporation, and they all profited enormously from the economic boom in Germany. Well, first, there was no economic boom in Germany, but there was money to be made, and they were busy making it. This is what banks do. They were selling German bonds to Americans because there was the idea that Germany, you know, was going to come back. But then we had the big depression, which caused everything to collapse again. But now still, in 1929, they're back to talking about Tyson again. You see how this goes back and forth between one group of people and another group of people. The Dutch and the Americans, and now back to the Germans. He quickly says that Tyson created the United Steelworks, which is just not a bank, an industry, the biggest industrial conglomerate in German history. And he hired Albert Volger as director, and he brought Friedrich Flick, who was another German man who had family business, on board of this United Steelworks, because Flick owned coal and steel industries throughout Germany and Poland, according to this article, which I won't dispute. So now here you have Flick and another German who's in the coal and steel business starting a new company called the United Steelworks. Has nothing to do with Bush at this point or with their banks or anything. Now this article tells us that Walker, George Herbert Walker, hired his son-in-law, which was Prescott Bush, to help him supervise the new Tyson Flick United Steelworks. Well, now, you see, wait a minute, I say. When did Walker Harriman get control of Tyson Flick United Steelworks in Germany? They didn't. Here's another example of writing in a disinformation style that Prescott Bush was only put in charge of supervising Union Banking's investment interests in Tyson's United Steelworks, whatever that might be. It's not clarified. The Bushes were certainly not supervising United Steelworks, a German company. One section of the United Steelworks empire was Consolidated Silesian Steel Corporation, the Upper Silesian Coal and Steel Company, located in Poland, in the Silesian section of Poland. Silesian section of Poland was a German section. That was where all the Germans were and had it been for centuries. So Tyson and Flick, it says, paid Bush and Walker generously, but they don't say paid them for what. We'll get back to that. So now it goes on. In 1927, Hitler was desperate for cash. Oh, yeah, yeah. What happened to all this money? His party was slipping into debt in 1927. Well, times were tough, and things were not going well, and he wasn't getting all this money thrown at him, like they like to say, by all these industrialists and bankers who were supporting him and kept his movement going. They admit here that wasn't going on. So Hitler asked, supposedly, told Rudolf Hess to try to get some money from a coal tycoon who was sympathetic to the party and whose name was Emil Kierdorf, just another German industrialist. So Kierdorf actually did come through, and he paid off Hitler's debt, according to this. But after that, he had no more money left to contribute. So Hitler got his debt paid off. Doesn't say how much. The money that Hitler was receiving from these industrialists, which he did receive donations from industrialists, was limited. It was not unlimited. It was not pushing, it was not backing him in any way that he needed. Now we have, says the following year, that would be 1928, Harriman and Company merged with the London firm Brown Shipley. So now Harriman, an American firm, with one of its business arrangements is a bank in cooperation with this Dutch bank. But now the whole company is merging with a London firm, Brown Brothers Harriman, which is something that many are familiar with. And they moved to a new office on Wall Street. And the Union Banking Corporation, which is the one that was in league with the Dutch bank, remained where it was, you know. Now it says that they established a holding company of 15 corporations. And one of the companies that were in this big holding company of theirs that they had stock in was Consolidated Silesian Steel Company. And two-thirds of the company was owned by Friedrich Flick, and the rest was owned by Harriman. Okay, so now we have the answer to what I was questioning above. At this point, let me quote from a UK Guardian article of September 25, 2004, that gives the basis of what the newly released U.S. government documents actually reveal. First, it says, the ownership of CSSC changed hands several times in the 1930s, but documents from the U.S. National Archive that were declassified last year, was when this was written in 2004, do not make it clear if he and UBC were still involved in the company when Tyson's American assets were seized in 1942. Now, first, and I'm quoting from this Guardian article, quote, the multi-billion dollar legal action for damages by two Holocaust survivors against the Bush family and the imminent publication of three books on the subject are threatening to make Prescott Bush's business history an uncomfortable issue for his grandson, George W., as he seeks re-election. Well, you know, here we go back to what I said in the beginning. This whole thing is being stirred up by Holocaust survivors. They have a big lawsuit. I think it's $40 billion they're trying to get from not only the Bush family, yes, $40 billion from the Bush family and the U.S. government. But, you know, this was several years ago now, and apparently they didn't succeed. Thank goodness. Now, next from The Guardian, it's in this 2004 Guardian article, it says, while there is no suggestion that Prescott Bush was sympathetic to the Nazi cause, the documents reveal that the firm he worked for, Brown Brothers Harriman, acted as a U.S. base for the German industrialist Fritz Thyssen, who helped finance Hitler in the 1930s. Well, there's a lot of assumptions in that sentence, and we're going to see a little bit further here if there's anything to them. Now, what's questionable is whether there's anything wrong with the Brown Brothers Harriman Bank or any banks holding assets of Tyson Fortune. I mean, is there? So the Guardian goes on to say, quote, three sets of archives spell out Prescott Bush's involvement. Now, this is important because now we're getting to this U.S. archives that are brought up all the time where all these documents are found that prove this whole business about the Bush-Nazi connection. So, quote, the first set of files, the Harriman Papers, in the Library of Congress, show that Prescott Bush was a director and shareholder of a number of companies involved with Tyson. Okay. Again, this vague reference to Tyson, very dishonest because no explanation of just what is meant by this is given. So now I quote again, the second set of papers, which are in the National Archives in Washington, show that on October 20th, 1942, the alien property custodian seized the assets of UBC, of which Prescott Bush was a director. It also says that after that, they also seized the books of other companies associated with UBC. Remember now, this is in 1942, and they had passed the Trading with the Enemies Act, by now, and so they had this alien property custodian which could seize assets of anything that had to do with that was supposedly aiding the enemy. Now, the third set of documents is also in the National Archives and contains the files on I.G. Farben, which company and its directors were prosecuted for war crimes, as you might know or not, during all the military trials after the war. Now, Fritz Thyssen had nothing to do with I.G. Farben, but that doesn't stop the disinfo folks from trying to link the two together. And you hear Farben and Thyssen linked together all the time. This is the way that they twist things around, and people, I'm only partway through this, but people who are reading this, they let themselves be carried along by what's being implied because they want to be, mostly. If they didn't want to be, they would be more critical in their understanding of what's being presented to them, which is just not the way it was, not the way it is. And we will continue with this, ladies and gentlemen, after the break.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
When it comes to war with Iran, the United States seems to come to the brink.
Bomb Iran, bomb, bomb, bomb. Anyway.
Only to step back again. The attitude is attacking Iran. We would never do it, but here's what would happen if we did. Economically, politically, and public opinion-wise. The Washington Post opined about the economic jumpstart war with Iran could offer the sluggish U.S. economy.
If you start a war in the Gulf, the Iranians will tend to close the shipping lanes of the Gulf. They'll make the tanker traffic impossible. At that point, the price of oil shoots up to $500 a barrel, and there's huge demand for dollars. So dollars, instead of being sloshing around in the gutters of the world, are immediately in demand, and you've saved the dollar for at least a few years. Now, that sounds fantastic. This is what was done in 1973.
War with Iran also has Republicans rallying around a common cause.
Our biggest national security threat is Iran. It's such an unstable government. We have such an irrational dictator there. Is in such a key location and funding the Al-Qaeda operatives in Iraq. And with nuclear arms, it is such a danger.
And it isn't just Republicans. Bush-era CIA chief Michael Hayden says options are running out.
When I was in government, what we would euphemistically call the kinetic option was way down in our list.
And he says Obama's aversion to bombing Iran is decreasing.
In my personal thinking, I need to emphasize that, I've begun to consider that that may not be the worst of all possible outcomes.
The Iranian threat makes it easier to take aim at other governments that aren't friendly to Washington. From China,
recent reports indicate that China has actively facilitated North Korea's providing Iran with advanced missiles and ingredients for chemical weapons.
To Venezuela, where congressmen called for a special task force to investigate the state oil company's involvement with Iran.
It starts with countries like Venezuela. We need to hold Hugo Chavez accountable.
I want to assure you that there will be no hesitation to take action against Venezuela.
Even following conflicting reports from the International Atomic Energy Agency, the mainstream media rarely questions the administration's claims that Iran is building nuclear weapons.
In the case of Iran, we know that Israel has put out documents which are fabricated, which are the center of this case against Iran. And that's really the main case of clear propaganda to make the case for war.
New revelations from WikiLeaks were quickly spun by hawkish congressmen into reassurance of support for war with Iran.
As to Plan B, the King of Saudi Arabia told us what our Plan B was. I'm hoping Plan A works.
With talks beginning.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour. brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I was talking to you about the Bush-Nazi connection and all that's been made of it. And we ended up, I ended up telling you about the Consolidated Silesian Steel Company. So, okay, now, this article then goes to December 1931, and again we're back to Fritz Thyssen, the German industrialist, who it says he then officially joined the Nazi Party. Well, you know, lots of Germans were joining the National Socialist Party at this time, including industrialists, business people, university people, because in 1931, they were becoming one of the most popular parties in Germany. So, well, let me say also there was every good reason for business and industrialists to like Adolf Hitler's party because it was the only truly anti-communist party. And here's the thing. In Germany, the labor unions had been taken over by the communists, and they were still under the control of the most labor unions, and a lot of people in the labor unions were loyal to the communists still. And it took a lot of work for the National Socialist Party to win over these labor union people. But they were doing it, and nobody wanted the communists in there, except, of course, the communists themselves. So this is why the Nazi Party, as it wasn't called the Nazi Party, it was called the National Socialist Party, was gaining ground and was becoming popular with so many people. Because of the kind of demonization that has been done since the war, people today think that, like back then, you know, it was some kind of evil influence, you know, evil force, and why didn't people recognize it? Well, it wasn't, and nobody saw it that way. It wasn't seen that way. All right, now it says that in 1932, Thyssen invited a group of German industrialists to meet with Hitler, which is true, and they had a long meeting with Hitler, and it says here that Hitler spent hours questioning Hitler, and who answered all their questions to their satisfaction, and this is right, and they thought that Hitler was the best choice for Germany at the time. Many of them did, and they donated to his campaign, which at that time then he got some more money. But it was not true to say that the money poured in, like they use the term here, the money poured in from industrial circles due to Hitler's monarchist attitudes towards labor and issues of class. Well, he didn't have a monarchist attitude towards labor and issues of class at all. That's a total falsehood. It's either a misunderstanding or a lie. But he was receiving enough money to keep his campaigns going and keep his party going. The majority of money raised by the NSDAP was in the form of small donations by average folks. This is an admitted fact. It did not come from fat cats or foreign bankers, but in small amounts from millions of average Germans. Now remember that the Dutch, Koenhoven, the Dutch banker, he was the managing director of that bank, and the Harriman Bank had established a union banking corporation back in 1924. So the article says that Prescott Bush became managing director of UBC, Union Banking Corporation, and handled the day-to-day operations of the new German economic plan. Can you believe that comment? The day-to-day operations of the new German economic plan. Well, that is totally just nonsense. What they're really saying here, but they want you to misunderstand it, is that he handled the day-to-day operations for the bank. Prescott Bush handled the operations for the Union Banking Corporation. But what they mean is whatever investments they had in Germany, which they would have had, allegedly Bush was handling. You know, he was the director of the bank. So that's what's really meant there, but they make it sound like he's handling Germany's economic plans. What nonsense. Then the article says, on March 19th, 1934, Prescott Bush handed Averell Harriman a copy of that day's New York Times. Well, this tells us that they had to read about what they're going to talk about here in the newspaper. They didn't know. They found out in the newspaper. And it goes on to say, the Polish government, this is what they read in the New York Times, the Polish government was applying to take over Consolidated Silesian Steel Corporation and Upper Silesian Coal and Steel Company from German and American interests because of rampant mismanagement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the Consolidated Silesian Steel Corporation and the Upper Silesian Coal and Steel Company were owned by this Friedrich Flick. And the Harriman Bank owned one-third of Consolidated Silesian Steel Company. Not the whole corporation, but this one company. But they weren't running it. You know, I have to say again, they weren't running it. They were reading about it in the newspaper. Now, that's just a little bit of information there. And then it jumps. The story jumps to 1939 with nothing further about that. Nothing. This was an article in the New York Times that said, you know, that the Polish government was applying to take over Consolidated Steel Corporation in 1934. Well, here's the thing. We know that there was lots of stress and a certain amount of conflict between Germany and Poland in 1934. So what I think this means is that the Polish government was making a lot of political noise. You know, this was in Silesia, and they had control of Silesia at that time, but Silesia was the German area, lots of Germans there, and the ownership of the industry there was probably in German hands still, and they were making a lot of political noise, saying, we're going to take this over because we've discovered some mismanagement and so on. All political, but nothing came of it. And the New York Times published it, you know, but nothing came of it because there's nothing more said about it. And then we jump to 1939, and Hitler's invasion of Poland, which they talk about, and that says that after that there was no more debate about these companies. So that was still going on from 34 to 39. Nothing was resolved about that, apparently. And the Consolidated Silesian Coal and Steel Company was in the mineral-rich and industrialized area called Silesia. And this is the same region that Germany built the Auschwitz concentration camp in, which is not surprising at all since it was a labor camp, and this was where there was all kinds of factories and steel companies and so on functioning, for which were very important to the war effort. So now at some point, the article doesn't tell us when, but it says that Tyson and Flick sold Consolidated Steel to UBC. This is what it tells us. It doesn't give us any details. But it now says, but supposedly, around 1939, they sold out, these Germans. They sold out to Harriman, and now it was under the complete control of Harriman and the management of Bush, and it became, and it changed the name to the Silesian American Corporation. Well, it says some more propaganda. It's trying to connect Bush with the slave labor force in Poland, which is a pretty far-fetched idea. It's not at all convincing. And it's just, they just keep interjecting this Holocaust propaganda. Now we jump way ahead, 6 days after Pearl Harbor and the U.S. Declaration of War at the end of 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, and U.S. Attorney General Francis Biddle, all three men, devious, evil personages, signed the Trading with the Enemy Act, because now, you know, U.S. was at war, so now they could have a Trading with the Enemy Act, and it banned any business interests with U.S. enemies of war. So it says that Prescott Bush continued through all this with business as usual, and that's what they do. It's what they've been doing. You know, we've had so many wars since then. And so the banks are busy making money off of these wars, and nobody says much about it. But this particular connection is, you know, is the one that, that they want to make out to be something way beyond what it was. And I'm not apologizing for the Bush family, but I'm just trying to get the facts out here. So now we come to some outright American-British propaganda. This article says, on October 20th, 1942, the U.S. government had had enough of Prescott Bush and his Nazi business arrangements with Tyson. So over the summer, it says, the New York Tribune had exposed Bush and Tyson, whom the Tribune dubbed Hitler's angel. What prompted this was the discovery that Union Banking Corporation had made huge gold purchases, raising suspicions that the bank was a secret nest egg for Tyson and other Nazi bigwigs. But of course, by 1942, Tyson was no longer a Nazi bigwig, if he ever was, and he was living in exile outside of Germany. The U.S. government had created the Alien Property Commission, which we already mentioned, through the Trading with the Enemies Act, and so they had the right to seize property that they considered to be of any help to the enemy. They seized a string of assets controlled by Brown Brothers Harriman, including their Union Banking Corporation and the Silesian American Company, which, if you'll remember, no longer had anything to do with Fritz Tyson or Frederick Flick by this time. It emerged that Roland Harriman, Prescott Bush, and the other directors didn't actually own their shares in UBC, but merely held them on behalf of the bank Roerhandel, that Netherlands bank that BBC was in partnership with, that continually is intimated that the Netherlands bank was really owned by Tyson, but it's never been proven. And now, Erwin May, the Treasury officer, this gets into a crucial part. Erwin May was Treasury officer in charge of the investigation. And he said, quote, "My investigation has produced no evidence as to the ownership of the Dutch bank," unquote. Then he cleared the bank of holding a golden nest egg for the Nazi leaders. So that's out. But then he went on to describe a network of companies spreading out from UBC across Europe, America, and Canada, and how money from Roerhandel, the Netherlands bank, traveled to these companies through UBC. Now, this Erwin May eventually found that Coel van Hoven, the managing director of that Dutch bank, was the director of the August Tyson Bank in Berlin, but it doesn't say when that was found out or exactly what that meant. And that he was a director in Fritz Tyson's Union Steelworks. Now, we're talking here about being on a board of directors. Those sitting on a board of directors are not running the business, the day-to-day business. They're not really in charge of the business. You know, there's quite a number of directors on a board of directors. So here again, it's connecting things that maybe don't have all that much connection. Now, a few weeks later, at the end of 1942, Homer Jones, who was head of the Alien Property Custodian Investigation and Research Division, sent a memo to the APC Executive Committee recommending that it take over UBC and all its assets. Now, this is at the end of 1942. Jones' memo named the directors of the bank, and then, and I quote, this is what is sometimes called a smoking gun here, he wrote in his memo, quote, "Said stock is held by the above-named individuals, however, solely as nominees for the Bank Roerhandel Rotterdam, Holland, which is owned by one or more of the Tyson family nationals of Germany and Hungary. The 4,000 shares therein before set out are therefore beneficially owned and help for the interests of enemy nationals and are vestible by the APC." Well, except that the proof that this Dutch bank was owned by the Tyson family has never been presented. And we also know that the APC was quite ready to grab hold of anything that it could get its hands on, you know, at that time within all that war hysteria and so on. But in fact, the APC, which Jones was sending his memo to, didn't follow his advice. And instead, the Union Banking Corporation was maintained intact and eventually returned to the American shareholders after the war. So we don't know whether there was anything to all that. It wasn't acted on by the government agency, so they couldn't have been too convinced by it. Returning to the article by Toby Rogers, is telling us that the bank and its shareholders are held for the benefit of the members of the Tyson family. And yet, it lists the UBC shareholders as Roland Harriman, 3,991 shares. Then a person named Cornelius Livense, 4 shares. Only 4 shares. Now, the rest of these shareholders have only 1 share. Harold Pennington, Ray Morris, Prescott Bush, H.J. Koevenhoven, that Dutch banker, and Johan Groninger. He only had 1 share. This is the total amount of shares. Now the article says, The UBC books also revealed the myriads of money and holding companies funneled from the Tysons. From the Tysons. I don't see any evidence of what is funneled from the Tysons. They just say that. And the government realized UBC was just the tip of the iceberg. Well, again, you see, nothing is given here. On November 17, 1942, the U.S. government also took over the Silesian American Corporation, but did not prosecute Bush. He says the reasons for this are that they thought it wouldn't help anything. They didn't want to bring attention to it. It would hurt the war effort, etc., etc., so they didn't do that. Are you getting the picture that this article cannot be relied upon? And it's one of the best ones of its type available. Highly read, because it's at the top of the search pages. So you see how the government, I mean, the U.S. government was deeply involved in propaganda, war propaganda. And so everything they were doing was from that point of view. So in 1943, it says, while still owning his stock, Prescott Bush resigned from UBC. And then he helped raise money for war-related causes, blah, blah. So now his stock was one share. He kept his one share of stock, and but he resigned from the company. All right, he was still a stockholder. Now, after the war, it says the Dutch government started looking into the books of the bank, of the Dutch bank, Boerhandel in Schreveld, the one we talked about in the beginning, and they discovered transaction papers of the Silesian American Corporation. That's true. And they began asking the bank manager, which was this Kuwin Hoven, questions. And he then was supposedly upset by that. So he traveled to New York to inform Prescott Bush. And now, according to this Dutch intelligence, which we are never shown, we're never given the name of this Dutch intelligence officer, Kuwin Hoven met with Prescott soon after Christmas 1947, and 2 weeks later, he apparently died of a heart attack. Nothing more is made of this, and that's left up to your imagination. Now we're in 1951, you see. The Allies put Tyson and Flick in prison and made them pay reparations simply because they were German industrialists. Then Tyson died in 1951, and after that, the government released the assets of the Union Banking Corporation to Brown Brothers Harriman. Brown Brothers Harriman were able to get all of that money, and it says the remaining stockholders cashed in their stocks. And you know what? Prescott Bush received $1.5 million for his one share in UBC. So all of those one shares were worth $1.5 million. So the almost 4,000 shares that Roland Harriman owned for the Harriman family, what were they worth? $6 billion. $6 billion? That's good. They got all that. Government didn't stop them from getting it. But quoting again from the Guardian article, some claim that Bush sold his share in UBC after the war for $1.5 million, a huge amount at the time, but there is no documentary evidence to support this claim, unquote. So here we have more of this story that is being disputed. So this is really what the argument is here, that these bankers who were supposedly cooperating with the Nazi regime, which really they weren't, they were just making money in Germany and off Germany, that somehow that means that there's this big connection and they're all Nazis, and all bankers are Nazis, and all bankers were funding the Nazis, and the elite now in control in the United States are all Nazis. And I mean, not just called Nazis as a descriptive term, but real Nazis, you know, that have their connection back in 1939 to 1945, or even 1933 or 1930, all that time. That they're all one big family, one big thing. But now listen to this. The article says, Bush Sr. appointed William Ferris to oversee a family fortune when he placed it in a blind trust when he became vice president. Okay, and now see, now they're going after this Farish. Farish's grandfather, William Farish Jr., on March 25th, 1942, pleaded no contest to conspiring with Nazi Germany while president of Standard Oil in New Jersey. Well, they found him doing some dealings, like everybody was doing. Still, on March in 1942, whenever he was doing it, and once they got this Trading with the Enemies Act, they were able to do a lot of propagandizing to get these big industrialists to admit to things that they probably didn't want to admit to, but that way they prevented having to serve time in prison or have a big fine. So as long as they admitted, no contest to conspiring with Nazi Germany, they were left alone. And now, you know, what happened to this Farish? Nothing. Admitted to conspiring. He was described, now here's where Harry Truman comes in. He was described by Harry Truman in public of approaching, quote, treason, unquote, for profiting off the Nazi war machine. Wow, isn't that something? Harry Truman himself. You know, these trials and these investigations and these Senate hearings and so on were all political. They don't mean that these American industrialists were prevented from getting all the money that they had supposedly earned. These people are not particular how they make money, and they still aren't. And that was all understood, but they had to have their political aspect to it that they could use for their propaganda about the whole point of it is to show how close we were to being taken over by the Nazis. They want to show that a lot of these wealthy Americans were cooperating with the Nazis, which shows that we almost were taken over by the Nazis. But we were saved by Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Democrats and the war and the partnership with Joseph Stalin. And all of that was so necessary because, oh, we were so close to it. And this is where people get the idea that they're propounding today, that the Nazis are now the Zionists. The Zionists are the Nazis. There's no difference between them. And then they have the whole theory that the Nazis and the Zionists were conspiring back then, and they're conspiring now, and that we can blame it all in the end on the Nazis after all. This is all this story, and the slew of documents in the Truman hearings amount to. Were these Truman hearings any different from the other famous Senate hearings used to promote their party's interests, full of grandstanding? And in this case, the Democrats could be hard on the richest Republicans, who were not as keen on getting into World War II as they were, and who could now be shown to be collaborators and make that out to be the reason they weren't so keen on going to war with Hitler. So in the end, this Bush-Nazi connection is made up of very little, that the Bush family, like so many others, including the Harrimans and many others we could think of, were more concerned with making money than anything else. I doubt they care that much about any particular political philosophy. But what has not been done is to establish a link between German industrialists and Third Reich policy. Therefore, any link between American, British, Dutch, and even German bankers with German industrialists does not lead you to the Third Reich hierarchy. Slave labor? Well, that's been going on since long before and still today. So what is all this focus on Nazism about? It's just a lot of politicizing that's in the interests of certain major players in power politics today. But what is behind this is British intelligence, in my estimation. Now, this may sound wild, but when I say British intelligence, I mean that in the broadest sense. British interests, you know, what Britain is doing to promote its own image around the world, and it still uses Nazism, anti-Nazism, and anti-Germanism, a deep, deep, deep current of anti-Germanism that is propounded by this to carry on its mission. I'm going to have more to say about this in the future, and next week I'm going to be talking about these particular, more into the Holocaust and the particular articles that Gordon Duff has written, and do the kind of questioning that I wanted to do with him, but I'll just do it on my own with you next week. So I hope you tune in, and that's it for tonight. I want to thank you for listening. This is Carolyn Yeager. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com.